Yeah, but he's from Wisconsin, Madison. He's a great guy. I've been able to meet him. He's a great guy.
Oh, thanks. So, is this echo chamber with this on? Is this okay? Sound okay?
You're warned that you're being recorded.
Yeah, I know. So I'm watching everything I say. So yeah, well, thanks a lot for having me over here. It's my first time to Perimeter, and the weather's just as good as in Wisconsin. So so I'm going to tell you today about some stuff that I've been doing with a bunch of collaborators to ask the following question. To what extent can very simple extensions of the standard model address the questions of the origin of visible and dark matter? And so what I'm going to try to tell you is that there are minimal TEB scale standard model extensions, or electroweak scale standard model extensions, that really can, with a few degrees of freedom, help explain the abundance of matter, that they can be discovered at the LHC, and that I think they have a good chance of, if they're discovered, of being probed in the cosmologically relevant region of their parameter space. So the talk I divided into three parts. I'll give you an intro and motivation. Because I'm going to be talking about the origin of visible matter, I'll do some review of baryogenesis, electroweak baryogenesis, and the electroweak phase transition. And then I'll discuss three minimal models as examples that I've been working on. And they involve adding 1, 2, or 3 degrees of freedom to the standard model, respectively. A real singlet, a complex singlet, and a real triplet. And they have these funny names that I listed over here. And I should just mention, I have a lot of collaborators in this work, so I won't be able to refer individually to a lot of the papers, but it's sort of a collective effort with many people. So let me start with the motivation. So the two puzzles are dark matter, the nature of dark matter and its interactions, and the origin of the baryon asymmetry of the universe. And of course, experiments are going to try to provide us some clues about both of these. For dark matter, obviously, direct and indirect detection. Experiments are key. And at the LHC, the sort of classic signature of dark matter is missing energy. For the baryon asymmetry, we need CP violation beyond the standard model. And one place to look for that is to search for permanent electric dipole moments of the electron, neutron, and so forth. And we also need to, if it's electroweak in origin, then we also need to have an electroweak phase transition. And so there, the LHC is going to teach us something, I hope, about the spectrum of beyond the standard model physics that might give us that phase transition. So theoretically, what you would like is that the solutions to these puzzles also address some of the other problems in particle physics, the classic, the gauge hierarchy problem. The tension between the electroweak precision data that likes a light scalar and the lower bound on the Higgs mass that comes from LEP, as well as the agreement of electroweak precision data that's so good that sort of says new physics should be around TEB scale, little hierarchy problem, and the origin of neutrino masses. So the solutions to these puzzles and these problems I like to divide into kind of two broad categories. One I'll call the non-minimal solutions, of which supersymmetry, which I've worked on a lot, is sort of the classic example. And the minimal version of this non-minimal solution has 105 new parameters, as we all know. And the reason people like it is that if you look at the list of puzzles and problems, it basically can address nearly all of them. And if you wanted to address the neutrino mass problem in supersymmetry, you'd have to probably give up dark matter through introducing our parity violation, but then you might explain the size of neutrino mass. But either way, SUSY is well-liked because of its success in addressing a lot of these problems. SUSY, of course, has complications that we all know. The mu problem, why is the mu parameter the weak scale and not the gut or the Planck scale? Why, if we have all these 105 parameters that generically predict lots of flavor and CP violation, we don't get that? And what is the origin of the parameters in the Lagrangian? SUSY is also rather constrained. The superpartner masses should be less than about a TeV if you're really addressing the hierarchy problem. If it's supersymmetric dark matter, if it's neutralino dark matter, then it has to be a very particular type of lightest supersymmetric particle that's a beano-higgsino-like particle. To get the electroweak phase transition, the right-handed part superpartner of the top quark has to be rather light, lighter than the top quark. To produce enough particle asymmetries during the phase transition, to get the baryon asymmetry, there has to be a very close coupling of the gaugeino mass with the size of the mu parameter. And there has to be a non-universality in the CP violating phases in supersymmetry. So there, with all the 105 parameters, they're already very tight. It's a very tightly constrained scenario. So the other sort of extreme is to look for the minimal solutions. And I divide these into those that involve extra scalars or extra fermions for the purpose of this talk. And So let's see how these could do in terms of addressing the puzzles. Extra scalars can pretty much address everything on the list except by themselves, not the gauge hierarchy problem. Extra fermions in principle can do the same thing. So it seems to me it's worth pursuing from the standpoint of the data that we have, what are the absolutely necessary ingredients in any extension of the standard model to address these problems. And then we can ask how are they embedded in some more general theory that addresses, say, the gauge hierarchy problem. So you'll notice in both of these cases, the gauge hierarchy problem is typically not something that can be addressed. So what I'm going to do for this talk is set aside the gauge hierarchy problem and not ask how do we solve that, but focus instead on the data. Gauge hierarchy problem is really a theoretical problem, and discuss the extent to which the minimal scenarios can explain the abundance of visible and dark matter and how they might be probed at the LHC. And I'm going to focus on the parameter space that's relevant to the LHC. So let me just give you the punchline of the talk at the beginning. And I'm going to talk about these three models, and they can be further broken down into those that have no gauge interactions and simple extensions that have gauge interactions. The simplest, with one new degree of freedom, is adding a real singlet. And what I'll show you is that you can either get an electroweak phase transition that you need for baryogenesis, and that will help also alleviate some of the electroweak precision Higgs mass tension, or you get a dark matter candidate, but typically you can't get both. The way you would see this at colliders is if you're in this scenario here, you would typically see reduced branching ratios for standard model Higgs standard model Higgs decays to standard model final states. And the way you would look for the dark matter, there's a similar signature at the LHC, but also you would see effects in the spin-independent cross-section searches. The next simplest without gauge interactions is to add a complex scalar with 2 degrees of freedom. And there, what I'll try to show you is you can actually address all of these problems with one model, and you would have all of the signatures that you would expect for both cases in the first scenario. Gauge interactions, the simplest extension involves adding 3 new degrees of freedom. And in case you've worked on 2 Higgs doublet models, that's actually 4 new degrees of freedom. So I'm not going to talk about 2 Higgs doublet models, which is probably more familiar to people. The simplest is the 3 new degrees of freedom. It's a real triplet, so it has no hypercharge. And again, it'll give you either a dark matter candidate or the potential to give you a phase transition that you need for baryogenesis. The collider signatures are rather different than the singlet case because there are gauge interactions. And at the end of the talk, I'll show you that the way to look for this guy, if it's a dark matter candidate, is to look for a charge track at the LHC. And in the more general case, what you would expect are anomalous excess of events of 2 photons and either a tau lepton and missing energy or 2 B jets and 2 photons, as well as changes in the branching ratios for the Higgs to decay to 2 photons.
Could you just have a complex scalar which couples everything?
You could. And yeah, I don't.
Why not address these problems?
Well, I don't know the answer to that, but the way we built this model is that we want to break a symmetry to get the dark matter candidate, and that would give an additional mass correction to the Z. And so it may work, but it's in a sense a little more complicated than this case here. So, but you're absolutely right. You could in principle do. It would also violate Castilio symmetry. Yeah. Yeah. So let's now go to the next part of the talk, which is kind of a review of baryogenesis and the phase transition and why these scalar degrees of freedom might be interesting. So I'll remind you that Sakharov pointed out the 3 ingredients that you need for successful baryogenesis, obviously baryon number violation, C and CP violation in the early universe, and some departure from equilibrium dynamics if CPT is a good symmetry. Physically, the way these sort of work is that baryon number violation in gauge theory comes through anomalous baryon number violating processes called sphalerons. C and CP violation is needed at some point to create particle asymmetries that end up driving these anomalous baryon number violating processes to make baryon number. And then you need a departure from equilibrium so that once you've made baryon number, you don't unmake it by the inverse reactions up here. So to prevent washout, you need a departure from equilibrium. The standard model has these sphalerons, and so that part works within the standard model. Where the standard model fails is in the last two elements here. There's not enough CP violation effects associated with the CKM matrix to give you large particle asymmetries. And even if you did have enough CP violation in the standard model, there isn't an electroweak phase transition, so far as we know, in the standard model universe, so the departure from equilibrium really doesn't happen. So you would have unmade a Baryonic symmetry anyway. So experimentally, the EDMs are looking for the CP violation that would address this issue here. And at the LHC, the possibility exists to discover new scalar degrees of freedom that might address this issue here. And so it's really this that I'm going to be focusing on the rest of the talk, and I won't be addressing the CP violation for now. It's a really another talk in itself.
You said if CPT is a good symmetry,
right?
It's compiling, you're trying to think of how it could be. Like, is there any?
Well, it's not in a gauge theory that we know, but people have these quintessence models, as far as I understand, can violate CPT, but I don't understand them, to be honest with you. I don't know. I don't know. People have, I think Kostolecki has done a little bit with CPD violation also. Not maybe in the context of baryogenesis, but to be honest, it's not on my agenda to really understand that, but people have thought about it.
But if you have a preferred cosmological frame, then that creates CPD, right?
Yeah, I don't know how to construct a reasonable field theory.
It's a spontaneous
violation. Yeah.
Yeah, that's why I think Kostolecki has worked on that, but it's just not my. Yeah, but I am at the limit of my knowledge on that, to be honest. So I'm going to stick with gauge theories that are a little more familiar. So let me describe a little bit the situation for the electroweak phase transition. So. Here's a cartoon of how phase transitions can happen. It's a plot of the free energy versus the Higgs-Vev. And what we want for baryogenesis is a first-order phase transition that proceeds in the following way. You start at high temperature with a symmetric situation. The Vev is zero. And as the temperature cools, you develop secondary minima that eventually become degenerate with the origin. And this temperature is called the critical temperature. And just below the critical temperature, what happens is bubbles of broken electroweak symmetry start to form by tunneling transitions to this vacuum. And eventually you cool down and you sit in this vacuum and that expands and becomes the universe today. It turns out that as the mass of the Higgs in the standard model is increased, you move away from this kind of situation to this sort of situation, which is a second order phase transition. And the key difference is that there's no bump between the broken minimum and the origin. And so you can sort of intuitively think about this as this allows for thermal fluctuations to knock you out of the broken symmetry and to wash out the baryonic symmetry if you're in this kind of potential situation. So we want to be over here. How this is realized more theoretically is by studying the finite temperature effective potential. So here's what it looks like at one loop in the standard model where I've taken the high temperature limit. As at zero temperature, there's a quadratic and a quartic term in the Higgs field. There's also a temperature-induced cubic term. You can see that the sign of the quadratic term changes as the temperature cools below some temperature T0, which starts this formation of secondary minima. But the key point for the phase transition is this cubic term. And what you need, basically, to prevent the washout of a baryonic symmetry is that the value of the Higgs field at the critical temperature here, divided by the critical temperature, has to be about greater than 1. And you can relate that ratio to this coefficient of the cubic coupling divided by the quartic coupling. And the quartic coupling can be rewritten in terms of the Higgs mass squared divided by the weak scale squared. And so you get this condition that involves the Higgs mass squared and this calculable coefficient and the weak scale squared. And these all have to work together to be greater than or equal to 1. So if you do a perturbative calculation of E, what you find is that the Higgs has to be lighter than about 40 GeV, which is obviously ruled out. There are non-perturbative calculations that suggest that any first-order phase transition in the standard model ends when the Higgs becomes about 70 GeV. And clearly, even if you go to supersymmetry, the Higgs mass bounds are typically larger than that. And so it's really hard, just with the standard model degrees of freedom, to satisfy this condition. So what can be done? Well, in supersymmetry, the trick is to add new loop effects to the finite temperature effective potential that increase the coefficient E. And the way it works is that the ones that do it are those that involve the top squarks, because they have the largest coupling to the Higgs. There are lots of them. There are three colors and two, it's a complex scalar degree of freedom, so you get about factor 6 or factor 10 rounding up. So if the stops are light, then you can enhance E by about a factor of 10. And at least in perturbation theory, this coefficient E goes up by about a factor of 3. And the bound on the Higgs mass goes up to something around 120 GeV rather than around 40 GeV. Now, there's a bit of a special parameter choice to make this work, which is why I'm not so fond of it. And the way it works is the following. The reason you get a cubic term in the potential is that in the high temperature limit, there's a contribution from scalars that goes like the field and temperature dependent scalar mass cubed. And that's what supposedly gives us this term. So the stop contribution, its mass squared, has a field dependent contribution. It has a zero temperature contribution that comes from the soft Lagrangian, and it has a Debye mass contribution. And so what people do in supersymmetry is they choose the soft mass squared to be negative and to cancel against the Debye mass so that you expose this phi squared and therefore a phi cubed term in the effective potential. And what this does is when you take the total mass of the top squark and add it to the top quark, the squark mass is around 100 to 125 GeV. So you have to have a light stop with this choice of the parameter space. So I think that's a very special choice. Maybe it's right, but it seems to me somewhat unlikely. So what I've been thinking about is what if instead of doing these loop effects with very specially tuned parameters, you look for new interactions that might affect this ratio. And what I'm going to show you is that if you add non-doublet Higgses, with or without SUSY, then there are two types of interactions that can do this for you. One that would lead to mixing between the standard model Higgs and whatever the new Higgs is, I'll call it S for singlet in this case, and the other interaction can lead to new decays of the standard model-like Higgs. And as I'll show you, both can in principle help enhance this ratio and get around the Higgs mass bound that makes it fail in the standard model. Yes?
Is there any reasoning in the SUSY scenario as to why it's just the late stop?
The left-handed stop has to be heavy to get the Higgs mass to be heavy enough, because there's a large loop-induced contribution to the Higgs mass from left-handed stops. And also, you want the left-handed stops to be heavy so it doesn't spoil electroweight precision data. So all the other superpartners, they have, unless you're in really large tangent beta region, their coupling to the Higgs are small, and so their effect in the loops is not as pronounced as the stops. So it's that coupling combined with the fact that you have three color degrees of freedom and two spin degrees of freedom that really works for you. But then you have to play this funny game with the soft mass. It is the soft mass. It is at the weak scale, yeah. Well, it's not really in the sense of, you do have to worry about color breaking minima when you analyze the effective potential because of the negative soft mass squared. But the physical masses are still positive. Yeah. So you have a heavy left-handed like stop and a rather light right-handed stop because you always have the top mass contribution after electroweak symmetry breaking that cancels against the soft mass squared. I think it's basically, I don't have a good, top-down approach, explanation of why you would expect this. There might be. People who know SUSY model building better than I do may be able to give a good answer.
And did you say that it's needed in the first order transition for the bending that?
To prevent the washout of the baryon asymmetry, right. So it's getting a large enough bump here, basically, through either these loop effects or these new interactions to prevent you from the sphalerons from being too fast after electroweak symmetry breaking starts. Because if they're too fast, they can undo the baryon asymmetry.
It's interesting because I'm considering a possibility that the massless QCD could be unstable on the generation of large quantum
state.
Giving like a kind of top effective mode. But the calculation is given in two loops, a logarithm which is going in this similar way.
No? You mean a similar kind of symmetry breaking?
In this way, and we expect that perhaps cell loop will give the minimum.
I see.
The top quantum state will be then the Higgs.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh. I'd like to hear more about that.
It's a kind of process of the same.
Interesting. Yeah. Okay. Well, we should hear more about that. So let me go on now and talk about the models that give us this kind of interaction. I'm going to use the simplest version as the illustration because it has the key features. And in this illustration, I'm going to use just one real scalar. The goal is to identify the generic features of these interactions that do either the phase transition physics we want and or give us a dark matter candidate, tell you about how the low energy phenomenology can be used to probe the physics, and then just mention again that I'm not going to address the CP violation problem with this particular model. So here's the model. It's very simple. The scalar potential has the standard model part, a part that depends only on the real singlet. And then if we restrict ourselves to renormalizable operators, which is what I'm going to do in this talk, then the interactions between the Higgs and the singlet, there are two that are gauge invariant that you can write down with coefficients I call A1 and A2. The A1 term typically leads to mixing between the standard model Higgs and the singlet. And the A2 term, it would be responsible for anomalous decays of the standard model-like Higgs to two singlet-like Higgses if the mass spectrum is favorable. So the way we work with this model is minimize with respect to the two fields. I'll call the Higgs VEV at zero temperature V0 and the singlet VEV at temperature zero X0. We count the parameters. We have 7 independent parameters in this model, which is a pretty small parameter set. The two VEVs, there are 2 parameters in the singlet potential that I didn't write down, the usual quartic coupling in the standard model, and these 2 parameters that govern the interactions, which are going to be my focus. So then once we have the potential, we need to work out the mass spectrum. So there's a mass matrix, which is diagonalized into the 2 mass eigenstates, which are mixtures of the doublet and the singlet Higgses. And I just want to point out that the parameters we're interested in, A1 and A2, appear both in the off-diagonal elements, which are responsible for the mixing between the 2 states, as well as in the lower right, which is governing the mass squared of the singlet-like guy. So by studying the mixing and the masses, one can get some handle on the parameters in the potential. It's the basic trick. Now, if you would want dark matter in this model, then to make sure that the dark matter would be the singlet is stable, you have to impose a Z2 or S goes to minus S symmetry on the potential. And you also can't have a zero temperature VEV for the singlet. And in that case, you can have a realistic dark matter candidate, but you don't get the phase transition because it would all come through loops. And 1 degree of freedom is not going to enhance the potential like in supersymmetry where you have, 6 or 7 or 8 degrees of freedom, depending. So I'm not going to consider that in this particular model, but I'll show you in the complex singlet extension, you can do it. So for LHC phenomenology, the key thing at our disposal to probe the model is something I call a signal reduction factor. And it's basically a product, so I call it squiggly squared. It's a product of the mixing angle squared for the given state and the ratio of the branching fraction for that state to decay to standard model final states compared to what a standard model like Higgs branching fraction would be. Okay. So the signal you get in an LHC Higgs search would be reduced either because you don't make it strongly enough or because it doesn't decay to the final states that you're used to it decaying to. Okay. So we're going to exploit the signal reduction factor in the phenomenology. And I should mention, by the way, this has already been done in the case of LEP. LEP looked for non-standard model-like Higgses. They looked through Z Higgstrahlung or associated production. And so they're sensitive to the same signal reduction factor, which I call sine squared theta here in this case, just assuming the branching fractions of the standard model are 1. And here's a plot of the limit on the mixing angle as a function of the Higgs mass from LEP. And so you can see as you go to lighter and lighter masses, you have to have less and less standard model strength. This signal reduction factor has to get smaller and smaller to be consistent with LEP. So we've already pretty much excluded a very light scalar that isn't very strongly mixed with the standard model. The LHC will be able to extend this range as well as the sensitivity to the mixing angle, as I'll show you. So I want to go back now that I've introduced the model to the finite temperature potential, and then I'll make the connection with the LHC. So here's the picture that we started with for the standard model. And now we have to add another axis to study the symmetry breaking because we have 2 degrees of freedom, the doublet that gets a VEV and the singlet that can get a VEV. And what we want to analyze is what's the shape of the potential and how does it evolve with temperature. What's the pattern of symmetry breaking? And then what are the conditions on the parameters and the potential so that at the critical temperature, the projection of the VEV along the doublet direction divided by the critical temperature is greater than 1. So you can imagine, as I'll show you, there's some minimum that sits over here that has a projection along the SU2 direction that is greater than 1. So we found that to analyze this, it was useful not to work in this Cartesian coordinate plane, but to introduce cylindrical coordinates. So I'm going to talk about a radial classical field and an angular classical field to analyze the potential. And so what we do is we compute V effective as a function of these two fields and the temperature, minimize with respect to them, find the critical temperature, and then evaluate the projection of the minimum along the SU2 direction. So one of the nice things about doing this in this sort of way is you can write down a formula that's analogous to what the standard model high temperature effective potential looks like in terms of phi and this other field alpha and temperature. It's a little bit more complicated than in the standard model. It has a quartic term where lambda bar now depends on alpha. It's an implicit dependence that I'll show you below. There's a modified cubic term. And then there's some quartic terms and a linear term and some logarithmic corrections that are not important for this discussion. So the key parameters in this potential are the coefficient of the T phi cubed term. And it's basically, that's the standard model term, modified by cosine to the fourth of this other field. There is a temperature independent cubic term that's basically coming from the A1 parameter in the potential. That's the and I'll show you again what the physics of that is. And then there's a modified quartic interaction that contains the standard model quartic coupling. And then there's a contribution that involves the interaction term, the A2 interaction, that's H dagger H S squared, plus some other terms that aren't important for this talk. And again, just to remind you what the physics is, A1 is a parameter in the potential that leads to mixing between the singlet and the standard model Higgs. And A2 would be the parameter responsible for anomalous decays in the standard model like Higgs. So by looking at these kinds of effects in the colliders, we have some probe on the parameters that are coming into the finite temperature effective potential that are important for the phase transition. Now, again, remember in the standard model, we wanted E over lambda bar, in this normalization, it's 2 lambda bar, to be greater than or equal to 1. What is this condition with the more complicated potential? Well, it turns out to look something like this. There's something that looks like E over 2 lambda bar, but it's modified by the new cubic term. There's a correction term here that I won't discuss in this talk, but if you're interested, I can tell you about later. And then this is the factor that comes from projecting the VEV along the SU2 direction. Okay. So you can see from this formula the strategies for trying to strengthen the phase transition. So we can, as in supersymmetry, try to increase the value of E through loop effects. So that's already been discussed. What the modified potential does for us is allows us either to increase the numerator by a large negative value of little e, and or one can reduce the denominator by changing the effective quartic coupling with a negative value for the A2 parameter. Okay, so that's the strategy basically that we're going to exploit. There's just some log corrections here that aren't, you know, at one loop aren't so important. You know, I don't remember because we didn't actually use this formula to calculate to determine whether we had a first order phase transition. We actually did a numerical analysis. So all I have is phi over TC that comes out of a numerical code. And this formula really gives us some guidance as to the physics of the numerical results, which is what I'm going to show you in the next little thing here. Okay, so let me show you that this formula actually gives us some good guidance. So what this is a scan over parameters in the potential that give a strong first order phase transition. We didn't use this formula to do the scan. We actually used the full potential after its minimization. The light points are those that come if we don't impose the Higgs mass bounds from LEP. The dark points are the ones that survive after you impose the LEP bounds.
How do you actually do this calculation?
So you knew it numerically, right. So as I described, you have a, you know, you know what the one loop form of the potential is, and so you scan over the parameters in the potential, calculate the effective potential, look for the minima and the critical temperature, and then evaluate the value of the field at the minimum divided by the TC. And if that ratio is greater than or equal to 1, then the point survives.
Okay. So you use that that criteria?
Yes, it's that criteria. And what I'm trying to say is that this formula gives a good approximation to what comes out of that. And I'm going to show that with this scan here. Okay, so I'm choosing a certain value in this scan for what I call the critical angle, this alpha, just to reduce the parameter space. But you can see that if we do a general scan, the values of A1 that give a strong first order phase transition are almost always negative, which is just what you expect, because a negative contribution to little e that comes from A1 increases the numerator. And in the places where A1 is not negative, A2 is negative, and that's because you're decreasing the denominator by reducing the quartic interaction. So we can basically get a very good understanding of how the parameters in the potential, these two key parameters, are really driving the phase transition. Now, if I would turn off A1 and another cubic term in the V sub S, then you see that most of the time, here I'm plotting the value of the zero temperature VEV of the singlet versus A2, this parameter, and almost all of the time it's A2 that is negative, and that's because basically you're driving the phase transition by reducing the effective quartic interaction. Okay. There are a few exceptional points up here where some of the other parameters that come in other places sort of twist things around, but it's basically that's the trend. So with that in mind, we can use this insight to try to study this model at the colliders. Okay, so let me... Oh.
So, the one comes out of that functional integral that Don did.
Yes.
But it really, he estimated it. And
yes.
And it's pretty insensitive to his estimate, but it was, one end of his estimate was 1, the other end was
1.3.
1.3, 1.4, so something. So is there a reason why people just always
take 1? Because the uncertainties are large enough that... well, actually, it's a conservative thing because it's phi over T at the nucleation temperature that is the real criteria. This is at TC. I think that as you go down in temperature, the ratio of phi over T increases. And so you know that if you start with a low 1, you're going to be above 1 as you go down. Now, 1 versus 1.3, that's a good question. I don't know what would happen, you know, in our scan if we, you know, impose that upper bound, but...
It's also not clear what would happen to the functional integral if we actually include other fields.
Yeah, I don't think the singlet is going to matter because it's the SU2 gauge bosons that are dominating. That's the Sphalerons. Mm-hmm. I think when we come to the triplet, where there's something that talks to the SU2 sector, then they will affect what this number is, it seems to me. And so there's some work to be done there in redoing that functional integral. But I don't think the singlet's going to make a big difference. But, you know, should be, it hasn't been, you know, scrutinized with a calculation. That's just my guess. Okay.
I have a related question. So this criteria, this is just the value of the vacuum, but wouldn't it, height of the potential matter?
Well, the height of the potential, if you solve the one, if you do it analytically and solve, the height of the potential is basically governed by this E over lambda. And so the value of the VEV at the minimum is governed by the competition between.
So that part I understand, but I think so that your starting criterion is the value of the VEV.
Yes.
Is that the only thing that's relevant?
Oh, I see what you're saying. What's really relevant is the Sphaleron rate.
Yeah.
And when people calculate the Sphaleron rate, there's an exponential that goes like the Sphaleron energy over temperature. And that Sphaleron energy is, as I understand it, proportional to the value of phi at that temperature. And so the criteria is that the rate be smaller than the Hubble rate. So that as
so
the
bubble. The actual height of the potential is not important?
It's not so important. It's the Sphaleron energy that's important. It's the peak in that, you know, that slide cartoon I showed you earlier of the Sphaleron. Well, I didn't show it, the Sphalerons. So their energy, which is the peak of the gate. If you plot the potential versus a gauge field configuration, you know, there's an infinite number of vacua, which are the Chern-Simons with different Chern-Simons numbers. It's the peak of the separation where the Sphalerons are living. So that's the Sphaleron energy. And it's that height that is important. And that's what's determined by phi, as I understand it.
There are these supersymmetric models with singlet extensions.
Yeah.
How much does it overlap?
Well, the reason why I did this is that there were, you know, like a gazillion parameters in the NMSSM type models and 7 here. So I could understand this. The basic thing is that in the NMSSM type models, you get an A1 type effect.
Yeah.
Okay. Typically, you don't get a negative A2 unless there is an interference between two terms in the superpotential, and they can have a phase, relative phase, which can give you, when you calculate the potential from the superpotential, a negative quartic interaction. But typically, in the NMSSM type models, you know, the little NMSSM or next to minimal or whatever, they don't have a negative A2 because they don't have this interference between multiple terms in the superpotential. But I don't see any reason a priori why that couldn't happen.
But do you, in those type of models, can you kind of get rid of the, can you make the stop heavier and just use the A1 effect to?
I believe so, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. So let me go now to the LHC phenomenology that comes from this simple picture and talk about the signatures. And so I'm going to show another version of that scan over the models that give you a strong first order phase transition. But I'm going to plot them versus the masses of the mass eigenstates of the two scalars. So the colors mean what they meant before. The black ones are the ones that survive the let bounds. M1 refers to the standard model like Higgs. And so you can see its mass is always greater than about 114 GeV. M2 refers to the singlet like scalar. So sometimes its mass can be lighter. What do these lines correspond to? This line corresponds to the region where the singlet like Higgs is greater in mass than twice the standard model like Higgs. And this is just the reverse region. And so there's interesting phenomenology associated with these two regions. So for example, if you lived in this region, the standard model-like guy could decay to singlet-like guys. And so you would expect reduced branching ratios at the LHC for standard model Higgs decays. If you're in this region here, you would expect exotic final states that you don't get in the standard model, because a singlet would decay to two standard model Higgses, and the standard model Higgses could decay to things like two photons, tau nu, or not tau nu, two photons, mu plus mu minus, BB bar, et cetera. So you might expect exotic final states if you're living over here. Now, one of the other things that we did that a lot of people in this business don't do, which is ask, what happens if you require that the model be consistent with electroweak precision data? So we calculate the contributions of the scalars to the gauge boson propagators and take the fits to electroweak precision data and require that the spectrum and the mixing angles for these scalars be consistent with electroweak precision data at 95% confidence and redo the scan. And you can see that the points that are surviving are far less than if you don't impose electroweak precision constraints. So the moral of the story is that electroweak precision data is a very restrictive consideration when you want to analyze this.
So I thought these were coupled to.
But they mix. So if you have
Higgs
and H and S mix, and so that's why. So the basic message is electroweak precision data likes the light scalar, and so if you have two scalars, then one can be lighter than it would have been in the standard model if it's not 100% standard model like, and it will help the precision electroweak data, but still satisfy the let bounds.
So this is like a mass mixing? So
yeah, mass.
So if you can undo the mass mixing and think of it as a coupling, just a modified coupling of the Higgs to the.
Well, but you're really resumming it, you know, when you diagonalize the mass matrix. It's not a small mass insertion approximation, which is how you would think of a coupling. I mean, the mixing is large. You know, it's not a, you know, 10 to the minus 3 mixing. It's, you know, 10% or larger, and so that you can't really justify thinking in the way you're thinking. I think you have to just diagonalize the mass matrix.
Yeah, that's what I meant.
Yeah, that's what we've done here. So you can see that the mass of the standard model like Higgs can still be heavier than what you would expect in the standard model. The standard model sort of bound from electric precision is about 150 GeV, and here you can go up to about 220 and still satisfy the electric precision data and get a strong first order phase transition. Now, it looks like there are no points in this region here, but that's just an artifact of the scan. So we redid the scan by turning off the interactions that are odd in S to amplify the effect on the branching ratios, which come from the A2 parameter, and redid the scan. And all the points that survive in that case are really below this line where you would expect changes in the standard model like branching ratios. So let me show you what those changes in the branching ratios would be. So here I'm plotting the mass of the standard model Higgs versus its rate to decay to two singlet-like Higgses compared to its rate to decay to standard model final states. And this blue line corresponds to this ratio being 1, And you can see that almost all of the points, the black points, that are electric precision data compatible, give you a strong first order phase transition, and are consistent with the LEP bound on the mass, lie in the region of this ratio being order one or larger. In other words, you would expect very substantial changes in the standard model Higgs branching ratios if you have a strong first order phase transition coming from this interaction. Okay. So that's quite interesting, I think. So then we can talk about this in terms of the signal reduction factor. So this scenario here would give a big signal reduction factor due to the changes in the branching ratios. The more general case would also receive a contribution by reduced production rates because of the mixing angle being non-zero. So let's see what that implies about discovery at the LHC. So in this plot, I'm plotting the signal reduction factor squiggly squared versus the mass of the two Higgs mass eigenstates. In this case, M1 now refers to the lighter of the two states, and in this case, to the heavier of the two. What we did is a scan over all the CMS traditional Higgs search channels and assumed 30 inverse femtobarns of data to get these points here, and I'll explain what those are in a minute. But just in terms to orient yourself, in these axes on the left panel here for the lighter state, if you're close to squiggly of order one, then this is a standard model-like scalar. Squiggly getting close to zero is singlet-like. For the heavier of the two, again, squiggly order one is standard model-like. Squiggly close to zero is either standard model-like but has a large branching ratio to the singlets, so that's the reduction in the signal, or it's just a singlet-like state. Okay.
What do the singlets pertain to if they're
lighter? They don't.
They're stable.
They're stable, right. Well, no, they can still have off-shell decays, right? They're just long-lived, right? They're not absolutely stable, just long-lived. So now what are these points? The points correspond to the following. The blue mean that you would, if you lived in this region, you would have a discovery of this eigenstate with greater than 5 sigma confidence. The pink means that you would have a discovery of the heavier of the two with 5 sigma confidence. The circle means you could discover both. And the red, which is sort of hard to see, means you could discover neither with that level of confidence. So let me overlay on this the region in squiggly space where you would be consistent with a strong first order phase transition very roughly. And you can see that there's quite a strong discovery potential of this model in this electroweak phase transition viable region of parameter space, okay, even with the signal reduction rates. Okay. I won't talk about how you could actually measure that signal reduction rate, but the moral of the story is that early, and I mean early in quotes, in the life of the LHC, there is a discovery of this scenario possible. And in principle, one could discover this, determine that this signal reduction factor is as low as a half, which means order one changes in the branching ratios here at the LHC. It's a few years. That's why I said early in quotes, because the model I'm going to show you at the end is 100 inverse femtobarns. And so, you know, this is for me, this is early. Yeah. But the Higgs is not early in the LHC. Yeah, yeah, that's to me early. Yeah, LHC is going to live a long time. Okay. So, okay.
So I have a question.
Yes, yes.
So let's say that one of these models are actually perfect. Then would they give you the right prior asymmetry?
No, they would be consistent with a strong first order phase transition. But the thing that this model won't do is the CP violation. And so something in addition. So the way I really think about this is that if you have a new scalar that is singlet-like that comes from some more general model, this is where it would have to live, okay? And then the other pieces of that, you know, that UV complete theory would have to give you the CP violation, okay? So let me now turn to a version of this that I can get both dark matter and the phase transition from. It's a complex singlet extension. And in this case, the most general renormalizable potential has a lot more terms than in the pure, the real singlet case. So what we did to A, simplify life, and B, get a dark matter candidate is we imposed a global U1 symmetry to start, and then we let it be spontaneously broken. So that'll generate a Goldstone boson, and that Goldstone boson would be the dark matter candidate. To make it a massive dark matter candidate, we then softly break the global U1. And so we end up with two states, a real and an imagined, or a scalar and a pseudoscalar. The pseudoscalar, the would-be Goldstone boson, is a stable dark matter candidate. The S, the real part of this field, acts like the real singlet of the previous model and has the same kind of phenomenology. Okay, so let me wipe out all the terms that don't survive these criteria and highlight one that survives. It's H dagger HS squared. It's basically our A2 term from the previous model. And what I'm going to show you is that this term now controls both the electric weak phase transition and the relic density. We also have to give the dark matter a mass. This is the soft breaking of the U1 symmetry. And then to prevent domain walls, we also had to break a Z2 symmetry explicitly with this parameter here.
What are the phi ones?
These are, in general, these can have phases.
Just okay.
Yeah, just keeping them general. For the case we want, they have no phases. They're real. And I'll show you in the next slide why that is. So we want a stable dark matter candidate. So here's the mass matrix. And there are no off-diagonal elements that mix the pseudoscalar with any of the real scalars. And because if there were, then you wouldn't have a stable dark matter candidate. And it turns out that to make these zero, you have to have no CP violation in the potential. And so those phases have been set to zero for that reason. Okay. Now, one of the interesting possibilities that we've been talking about is maybe there could be spontaneous CP violation at high temperatures that would be the CP violation you need for the baryon asymmetry that would be a problem for dark matter, but maybe that spontaneous CP violation could quench as you turn down the temperature to the temperature where dark matter relic density is produced so that you still have a dark matter candidate and some CP violation at earlier times. So that's something that I've been thinking about a little bit, but I don't know if this will work or not. Okay, so I'm going to, for now, concentrate on the case with no CP violation. So here's a plot now that shows the relic density that comes from this model on this axis versus the dark matter mass for a given set of input parameters here. The really thin line is the WMAP value. The all these funky colored lines correspond to different choices for the delta 2 parameter, the quartic coupling, that basically comes into all of the annihilation diagrams that are relevant for the relic density. Okay, so delta 2 controls for fixed masses the relic density. So for example, the light curve here is a very small value of delta 2. The dark curve is a very large value of delta 2. And so you can see that depending on the masses in delta 2, you can get a value for the relic density that's consistent with WMAP. In addition, typically, unless you're near a Higgs pole, which is one of these kind of diagrams where the mass of the A is roughly half of the mass of H1 or H2, then you like to have large values for this quartic interaction. Otherwise, you overproduce the dark matter. And that's good for phase transition physics if the sign of delta 2 is negative, because that reduces this effective quartic coupling in the effective potential. So in principle, the favored region of parameter space for dark matter in this model is also the favored region for the electroweak phase transition.
So those two sinks or features in your diagram on the right here.
Over here.
They all basically go down, and they go up, and they go down again.
Yeah.
What is the physics of those things?
There's a resonance in this cross section because of the Higgs pole. So you can produce a real Higgs here. If the dark matter mass is half of the mass of the exchange particle. So if the cross-section goes up, then the relic density goes way down.
So that's both of those?
Both of those, because there are two mass eigenstates. So there's a light scalar and a heavy scalar. In this illustration, you know, depending on what these masses are, where these sinks occur will be in different places. So the moral of the story is that, you know, given the masses, you can choose delta 2 to be consistent with WMAP and also get the phase transition. I won't show you, just in interest of time, the relic density of the spin-independent cross-section, but it's rather insensitive to delta 2, and it's certainly within the range of discovery at, say, super CDMS or some of the future experiments. What I want to tell you about is the LHC discovery of this model. And so here I'm plotting an analog of that scatter plot that I showed you earlier. It's the Higgs mass versus the, in this case, the signal reduction factor squared. And basically, in this region here is where you could get a 5-sigma discovery at CMS with 30 inverse femtobarns. But there's actually another strategy for looking for this model. It's something called an invisible search, which could be done at ATLAS. And what the invisible search is sensitive to is when one of the Higgs decays to something that is not seen in the detector, which is why it's called an invisible search. And what you do is you look in something called vector boson fusion, where the two protons come in and they exchange two W's or two Z's that produce one of the Higgs mass eigenstates. And that Higgs decays to the two pseudoscalars, the dark matter. And these are not seen in the ATLAS detector. What ATLAS says they can do is they can, so I'll explain how you can look for something that you don't see in a minute. But the ATLAS sensitivity is right in the region where you would expect the invisible branching fraction. This is basically that same Higgs decays to the singlet-like guy in that region of order one where the electric phase transition is favored. Okay, so where this interaction gets large, the branching fraction to invisible gets large, and that's the phase transition favorable region, and that's where ATLAS can look. So how does this invisible search work? I won't talk about the central jet stuff here. The basic idea is the following. So here's a picture of PP collision, and this is the reaction plane. And what happens is that the outgoing quarks are jets that will have some distribution in angle phi, azimuthal angle, relative to each other. And it turns out that if you're producing a Higgs that decays invisibly, then the two outgoing jets tend to be on the same side of the reaction plane. Whereas if you have a standard model background, the outgoing jets tend to be on the opposite side. So that's plotted here, which is phi jet jet versus the cross section. The Higgs invisible decay distribution is given by the red line. The typical QCD plus two jet production is given by the black line. And you can see that the invisible decays of the Higgs are peaked in the upside part of the distribution, whereas the standard model-like background are tend to be in the back-to-back direction. So what ATLAS will do is look at this angular distribution to see if they've seen an invisible signal by looking at the outgoing jets. Okay. So it's quite interesting, I think. So let me not say anything more about this model now and turn to the real triplet and discuss a little bit how the phenomenology is different and what might be different for the phase transition in the last 10 minutes or so. So here are the quantum numbers. It's a color singlet, SU2 triplet, no hypercharge. The neutral component is going to be the one that acts like the singlet of the previous models in terms of phase transition or dark matter. The potential that you write down that's renormalizable that involves sigma and H is rather similar to the real singlet case. There's two interactions that are gauge invariant between the triplet and the standard model doublet. Cubic and aquatic interaction that you can write down. And I call the coefficients the same thing as in the real triplet, the real singlet case. And they have basically the same physics. This would lead to mixing between the two states, and this would lead to anomalous decays. Okay. And again, I'll call the value of the VEV of the neutral component at zero temperature x0. This has no fermions. No, it's fermiophobic, because I'll show you in the next slide. No, it's all controlled by the zero temperature VEV. Okay, and because it has no hypercharge.
Yeah.
So you can't write down a gauge invariant. If you built a gauge non-invariant operator, you a higher dimension operator, in principle, you could do it. Something like sigma squared, q bar h u, for example, a dimension six operator. But you know, that'll be suppressed by whatever the new physics scale is that has generated that operator. Okay. So let me sort of summarize some generic features now that makes this kind of scenario a little different and kind of interesting compared to the singlet case. So the first is that because you have gauge interactions, there's a large cross section for two sigmas to go to two a W plus and W minus. So for the dark matter scenario, the annihilation cross-section is typically very large unless the particle is heavy. And so to get the full relic density, the mass of this triplet has to be around 2 TeV, okay? Unlike the singlet, which can be very light, order 100 or less GeV. The rho parameter tells us that any non-doublet VEV has to be very small at zero temperature. And in this case, the VEV has to be less than about 4 GeV. And this means that there's going to be very small mixing between this triplet and the doublet and very little impact on electric precision data. Because there's no hypercharge, it starts off with no coupling to fermions. The only way it couples to fermions is through the mixing is small, so it's fermionophobic. And the question we're studying right now is whether, with this strong constraint, we can still get a strong first-order phase transition through effects in the classical field at finite temperature. And I don't know the answer to that question, so I'm going to just tell you about the phenomenology. But that's the...
It does mix the things, so it's an effective...
Yeah, but very small. Yeah, but the anomaly shouldn't depend on the BEV.
Why would it affect the anomalies at all?
I mean, that's a dimensionful parameter. It shouldn't affect the anomaly.
At scalars, that will.
The scalars don't give anomalies.
Scalars are a different
scale. This is a scalar.
But it's a triplet scalar.
Yeah, it's a triplet. Yeah.
It's still
fine. Yeah.
Okay,
yeah.
I like the main question.
Yeah. So, okay, so the spectrum has four scalars, two neutral and two charged. There's a triplet-like neutral and a standard model-like and two charged guys. It has interesting couplings to charged particles that can change photon decay branching ratios, which I'll come to in a couple of slides. But let me talk about the LHC part of this and start with the production cross-section. So here I'm plotting the way you produce this, because you know you're not going to produce it through gluon-gluon fusion because it doesn't couple to top quarks very strongly. You're going to produce it in Drellian pair production by making either a W that decays to a charged and a neutral guy, or a Z or photon that decays to an H plus H minus. And so what's plotted here is the relevant production cross section as a function of the mass. And you can see that at light masses, it's order 1,000 femtobarns, but drops pretty rapidly. For the LHC, typically, the good discovery potential lies in the light mass region, which is up to about 160, 170 GeV, below the WZ threshold. Above that, typically, one needs to look at a linear collider. So I'm going to mostly concentrate for the general case on this light mass region. And what we found is that the way to look for this is to look for these kinds of anomalous final states that come from the decays of the charged and neutral triplet-like Higgs to extra photons in either BB bar or tau nu. Okay. So one other feature of this model is that the decay length is quite sensitive of the charged triplet is quite sensitive to the VEV. The charged guy always decays because of electroweak symmetry breaking. Loop infects make its mass larger than the neutral triplet mass. And so there's always the decay of a charge to a neutral plus a virtual W, which means a pion. And so it's never going to be stable. The charge one's never stable. But at the limit where the VEV is zero, you get a dark matter. That's the dark matter limit. You can see what the decay length is, and it's about 5 centimeters in the detector, which is something you could actually see. You know, and if it would actually decay, you would see a secondary vertex. But in the dark matter limit, you would see a charge track that then just basically disappears. So our signature is to look for a charge track that disappears through this kind of production mechanism. And to find it, you have to, at the LHC, you have to trigger on something, because this is a rare event. And so you trigger on a monojet that comes from initial state radiation and large missing energy because, it just disappears and the H2 isn't seen. Here is the problem. The problem is standard model backgrounds that produce missing energy. The same trigger will pick these guys out. And compared to the production cross-section for this model, the standard model background is something like 2 orders of magnitude larger. So how are you ever going to see this at the LHC? The trick is to do some cuts that involve basically looking for this charge track. And when you do that carefully, you basically wipe out all the standard model background and expose this. Okay. So what is discoverable in terms of a dark matter candidate? So we can ask, what fraction of the relic density would a discovered charged triplet at the LHC give us? So let's take a representative case where you see something like, 10 to 50 events, which is right here. That corresponds to a mass of around 500 GeV. And then you can ask, how does the relic density depend on the mass? So here's a plot of the relic density versus the dark matter mass. The red line is after including the Sommerfeld correction. And if you go down to 500 GeV, then you see that this is about 1/10 of the relic density. So for this particular scenario, if you discovered at the LHC, and that's after, like 100 Embers femtobarns of data, it would give you, at best, a tenth of the relic density. Okay, so the singlets are a lot better because you can see them, you know, more copious.
So this 3 TeV region, can you have the whole stuff that would take much longer?
No, there's no way. No, linear collider. But you'll never get built, yeah. Well, click or something, I don't know. Anyway, okay, so let me conclude with the general search, and then I'll give you my summary. So if you're not in the dark matter scenario, in other words, where you have a non-zero BEV for the real triplet, then the first thing to utilize is the fact that the branching ratios depend of the charge guide depend very strongly on the BEV. So for the light case, for the small BEV case, the dominant decay is to a neutral plus a pion. For a large BEV, X of order a GeV, the dominant branching ratio is to a tau. So in this case, you would see extra B quarks. In this case, you would see a tau in the final state. And that leads to our search strategy, which I'll show you in the next slide. So we're going to look for this kind of process where you make either a W and a charged guy and a neutral. And the charged guy will decay either to a tau nu, and the H2 will decay to two photons if the BEV is large. Or if the BEV is small, the charged guy will decay to a neutral plus a pion. The neutral will decay, one of the neutrals will decay to two photons and the other to a BB bar. And so depending on where we are in the BEV space, one can look for this kind of scenario. I won't talk about the cuts just because it's probably a little more detailed than people here are interested in. But let me show you the basic punchline, which is what is the signal over root background for this search? So here I'm considering a case where the BEV is large, so we get a two photon tau nu signal. The histograms correspond to S over root B for different masses of the triplet after 100 inverse femtobarns of data. And the different values of the different colors corresponds to different values of the parameter A2 in the potential. So depending on what you get some information and what the mass is, you get some information on this coupling and the potential based on this this final state. Now, here is for the BB bar tau nu, BB bar two photon, and it's the same basic idea. You get a histogram whose size depends on, or expected S over root B, that the size depends on the value of A2. The other way to look for this guy is through the coupling to two photons, and this will be sort of the last thing I talk about. And there's a very peculiar feature of this model, which is the coupling of the neutral triplet to two Ws depends on the, it's always proportional to the VEV, and it depends on a number and a ratio R. R is a function of the masses of the scalars and the A2 parameter. So by looking for things that, properties of the H2 that depend on its coupling to two Ws, you have some probe of this A2 parameter. The same is true, therefore, in two photon, if you make a W loop where the H2 decays to two photons through a W plus W minus loop, that's a way to look for the effects of A2. Same is true for H1. H1 couples to the two charged guys through this A2 parameter. So the standard model like Higgs to two photons through H plus H minus loop effects is also sensitive to A2. So we can plot, for example, the branching ratios of the triplet-like as a function of A2, a function of masses for different A2. And if you look, for example, at the two-photon branching fraction, if A2 is minus 1 versus plus 1, sort of extreme ranges, you can see that the two-photon branching ratio is quite dependent on this parameter. Okay. Same is true for the standard model-like Higgs to decay to two photons. Here's a plot, again, of the change in its branching ratio relative to the standard model two-photon branching ratio as a function of the mass for different values of A2. And you can see that for light charged triplet, there can be rather dramatic changes in the two-photon rate, which, again, are sensitive to A2. So here's sort of a summary of the phenomenology for this sort of general search. To get the mass, or using the mass and the decays, you can get a handle on the VEV and the A1 parameter. I haven't really talked about that, but the mass of the charge guy depends on A1 and the VEV. So the branching ratios tell you about X0, the mass and the branching ratios then give you these two guys. And then the coupling of H1 and 2 to two Ws gives you a handle on A2, as I've discussed. So let me summarize, and so hopefully you'll take away this message that these minimal models have a good potential to help explain the origin of visible and dark matter, that there's good discovery potential at the LHC in many cases, that looks like they can be probed in the cosmologically relevant parameter space. And here again is just the summary of everything that I discussed. Okay? Thanks. Yes.
When you measure two protons choking and generating omegas, and the omegas then generating a Higgs,
yes,
process like this, if these two protons A that you mentioned are not appearing, what constitution on the Higgs this process can pose?
Well, the decay. So the masses of the two A's has to be less than half the mass of the Higgs. And so that's a restriction number one, because the branching ratio fraction, I mean, it has to be a kinematically allowed decay. And then the branching fraction has to be typically greater than 50% for this invisible channel. And so that means that the mass has to be greater than twice the dark matter mass. And the coupling, this A2 coupling, has to be relatively large. So that's what you learn from that.
Thank you.
Turn off the mic.
We'll cut it off there.
Okay.